Welcome to the Invest with Clarity podcast, where you will learn how success in investing, as in life, is the result of absolute clarity. Mark Pearson of Nepsis in Minneapolis, Minnesota, shares his passion for portfolio management and commitment to transparency and communication to allow investors to fully understand what they own and why, bringing them to clarity in their investments. And now, here are your co-hosts, Matt Halloran and Mark Pearson.
Hello and welcome to another Invest with Clarity podcast. I am your host, Matt Haller, and actually I'm going to be turning over the reins to Mark Pearson. Today we are going to finish up our five-part mini-series with Chuck, the man, the myth, the legend, because we're talking about really truly knowing what you own and why you own it. All right, Mark, I'm going to turn it over to you, my friend.
Thanks, Matt. Always good to be with you. Always good to have Sir Chuck on our podcast with us, of course, for those who don't know. Chuck has had a research here at Nepsis, and as Matt alluded to, we're going to be finishing up the final piece of a five-part series of knowing what you own and why you own it. And just to tantalize the taste buds a little bit, we are recording this on December 29th of 2021. For those of you who are eagerly anticipating and waiting for the top 10 predictions from me, our next podcast will record next week. Hopefully get it out in the next two. You'll get to hear my top 10 predictions for 2022. And by the way, Matt, as you may or may not know, and of course Chuck knows, we were once again 100% correct in our predictions. And I don't know anyone on CNBC or Fox Business, any of those programs that get on and prognosticate, postulate, and speculate, and frankly, guess at what they think is going to happen next year in the markets, because frankly, that is exactly what it is a guess. But we prefer to take a more prudent, common sense approach in our predictions. And as you, Matt, we've been doing these since 2012. And I felt so good about last year going to 20 predictions from 10 for the roaring 2020s, that for 2022, there's another two in the year. We're going to do 20 again. So buckle up, kiddies. The predictions will be back out, and we'll do a podcast on that in a couple of weeks. All right, now to the matter at hand. And oh, by the way, also be ready. We got the final two pieces of the four keys that you and I are dissecting under the hood, and I'm going to have Chuck join us on those as well. We're going to have Chuck on a little more often, so he works a little harder. I'm just kidding. Chuck works
hard. I know. That's okay.
What I'm going to do is, for this final piece, Chuck, I'm going to turn it over to you, give a little bit of a recap for the last four of knowing what you own and why you own it, and let's wrap this baby up in a bow and give people some investing clarity.
Thank you, Mark. A great lead-in as always, and this has been exceptionally exciting for me because it's a saying that you've used as long as I've known you, that it's all about knowing what you own, right? And why you own it. Those are two keys. So what does that actually do? And that was the first episode that we went over. And what it does, it's this great mitigator, or it's an elixir, if you will, the prescription about eradicating emotion. And the way that we described emotion was vis-a-vis the famed Dalbar study, right? You and Matt, I think, have done a couple of podcasts. We used to do the radio show. We talked about it all the time.
Yes.
And just for the listeners.
Dalbar study, yes.
Yeah, it's an amazing study because Dalbar is this independent firm headquartered in Boston, Mass. And going all the way back to 1990, they do this annual study. And the study is quite expensive. You're always gracious enough to let the research department get its hands on it because it's packed with information that basically says one thing, and I'm going to kind of quote the most recent study here, is that the greatest impediment to investors not reaching their goal is that they use emotion in the decision-making process. So why does knowing what you own eradicate emotion? And I think that's what we're going to kind of follow the next line of thinking here. And it's amazing that the Dalbar could come up with so many different quotes to capitalize what they wanted to say and what they call this QAIB, the quantitative analysis of investment behavior. That's their creme de la creme study, if you will. And I'm just going to again read this. They said the wrap-up of last year's study, which of course was 2020, right? Because 2021 hasn't ended yet. The greatest impediment to one not reaching their own personal investment goals is using emotion in the decision-making process. So
yeah,
that was
it's key. It's huge. Sorry to interrupt you real quick. Just to remind listeners, and of course, Matt, I think already knows this also, this is the foundational component to the four keys to successful investing.
Exactly.
The philosophy and the strategy are your empirical pieces. We've talked about this multiple times before. And the flexibility and the transparency are the behavioral components of investing. And I believe, we believe at Nepsis, that you need to have both for long-term, or certainly the opportunity and potential to increase your investment success. And this study, which I'm anxious to hear you talk more about today, is critical on the behavioral side. And this is why we don't benchmark. This gets to the core of a lot of the reasoning behind our brand of Investing with Clarity.
Yeah, Mark, you said it so exceptionally well. And we talked a lot also about, as we get to kind of this episode two recap, was business ownership, right? I hear it all the time. Part of this podcast, of course, we're listening to CNBC, and they have their halftime report, and they get apparently what they believe to be the top either money managers or analysts on there. And what's amazing is you maybe have a handful of those that are out there that actually believe it's about business ownership. People talk about the market. They talk about owning the stock market, if you will. And what I love about you, she said, it is the greatest thing, right, since sliced bread. Yes. Because what does it allow one to do?
Take advantage of opportunities when they go on sale.
Exactly. It's like people, if they viewed what the stock market truly is, right? It's like going to the supermarket, right? You're doing what? You're looking at produce, you're looking at beef, and you're checking it out. And you're saying, is this worth the cost of ownership? And you make a decision as to whether you buy it or not, or go to another store, buy another product, right? I mean, it's really that simple.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's interesting. People, I just finished up the verbiage on the predictions for this year. And one of the comments I made in the piece was the idea that people chase benchmark returns and they don't even know what companies contribute to the returns that come in the benchmark. And let me give you an analogy, or not an analogy, let me give you an example of why I think that is completely ludicrous. Business owners, people who own a business like myself and other business owners like Matt, I can guarantee you that most business owners can tell you where their biggest revenue sources come from, where their biggest profits and losses come from in their business. If they didn't, they wouldn't be able to manage a business. And it's the same way when you own a bunch of businesses and not a quote unquote benchmark, because a benchmark is opaque in and of itself. And investors put their money in and hope and pray their money is going to make money while they don't even understand how they're going to make the money. I just don't understand it. It's just common sense is uncommon.
That it is. And you think about this emotional factor that's there, right? Because it's the opposite of what you just said and what we preach and what's in our name, right? Which is clarity, is this concept of uncertainty or ambiguity, yes, right? Or a lack of knowledge. And that was all wrapped up, meaning those three actually decision-making components are connected to fear. And and that's what drives people's decision-making, right?
Right. Well, and people make, not only do they make their decisions, a lot of times they make them quickly. They make them based on the emotions, not on the fundamentals. It's kind of like one of my advisors was having a conversation with a client this week who's in the real estate business. He looks at his account, his statement looks at his account probably almost every day, looks at his statements, and he expects to see his account going up every day. And I mean, that's just absolutely ludicrous. First of all, you don't make any money or lose any money on an investment until you sell it. That's number one. Number two, we have stated in our investment policy statement that you have to be willing to hold a company for 7 to 10 years to reap the full benefits of the opportunities.
Absolutely.
Now, it doesn't mean we don't sell investments quicker because we have a buy discipline and sell discipline, but it is designed to get the investor to think long term. And if the investor can think long term, this is actually a behavioral piece of the process because you're thinking long term, not short term.
Mark, excellent. And you think about this too, this emotion that you said is quick. And remember, when we have the thought process that enters our brain, right? The emotion piece kicks in first, right? And this emotion really is fear. And it comes from a lack of knowledge, a lack of confidence, a lack of trust, because there is no process in that decision-making process. So,
correct.
So you ask yourself, how does one overcome fear, right? And we always talk about fear and greed in our industry. Yes, there's greedy people in this industry, right? But they're probably the everyday investor isn't greedy. They have two fears. They have fear of loss, and they have this fear of missing out, right? And that's that comparison issue that we talked about. The thief of all joy is when you constantly compare yourself to somebody else or something.
Yeah. And it just doesn't work.
It doesn't work. And
people do it anyway. You can tell them 1,000 times. But they still do it.
Yes, they do. And
what's that Ben Franklin quote, Matt, about the definition of insanity?
It was actually Albert Einstein.
That's Einstein. Yeah, it's doing the same thing and expecting a different result.
Yeah, same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. I love it. Okay.
Well, I'll give you guys another quote here, which was the famed FDR quote regarding fear. And I remember when this time was. It was his first speech to Congress that he gave in 1933, right? And here we're kind of in the depths of the Great Depression. Think about this, the stock market had sold off 90%. And I'm going to read this directly because we always think about the first part, but we don't think about the last part. So here's what he said. Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. We've all heard that piece. But here's the second part. Now, Mark, I want you to relate this to investing. So the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. Now, how would that relate to a sell-off in equity markets, right? What do people do? They have this nameless, unreasoned, unjustified terror.
On one hand, we try to convince people not to be fearful, but quite frankly, I'm grateful that people are fearful. Think about it. If I didn't have people out there that were fearful and selling companies for any reason other than fear, I wouldn't get as good of an opportunity to buy a company on sale. And when you take the emotional aspect out of the investment process, I cannot tell you how much of a value that can provide an investor. And so when people do retreat, when people do get paralyzed, when people do get scared, when people do try to time investments and not time in an investment, I like to get greedy. I'm not going to lie about it. It may be one of my weaknesses, but listen, I like being greedy when everybody's fearful.
A la Warren Buffett. And I remember I go back to when we used to do live shows, right, which we're going to do more of these. You used to get on the horn and the market had closed and the headlines say the Dow was down 500 points today. You get on and say, I'd like to thank everyone today for selling me very solid businesses at discounted prices. Yes. Imagine if the press would actually do that. We wouldn't have this nonsense, but thank goodness we do.
I think professional investors are insensitive and they're not nice to people. I mean, they should be thanking people for letting go of their businesses at a discount for us to buy, right? No one ever says, hey, thank you for selling me that stock at a gross discount. Thank you. Listen, I publicly want to say this. I want to thank everybody who in 2020 sold their Devon Energy at $9, $10, $11 for me. Thank you. If I haven't thanked people enough yet, I'm going to thank them now. Thank you, everybody. It's at what now, Chuck? 44?
It is. Yeah. Now you think about how many X fold that's up. 5X.
How long did people really think that oil was going to stay in a negative price range? It was a no-brainer. Anyway, sorry, I digressed.
No, it's an excellent example.
I was just trying to be nice.
Yeah, you are being nice, and it's an excellent example. So
I'm here we sarcastic today too, aren't I?
Yeah, there you go. That's all right. That's always a little edgy
in your head.
Yeah, there you go. Which was so we have this episode too, right? This fear that only is overcome by knowledge and understanding. And one of the things that again you've preached, which I love, is we get into episode 3, which we talked about the studies that have shown that the high conviction or the best ideas of a money manager are the ones that actually, no matter what your process is, it's not talking about specifically what is the process of the secret sauce. Right. It's that you have one and you exercise with confidence and you're consistent in it to have you talk a little bit about that. And here's the in vein before you get to in this vein of the market preaches diversification and in the great Buffett quote on being over diversified and owning so many companies, you can't know and follow 3,000 companies. And that's what leads to emotion because you don't want to know anything about 3,000. You can know about 30 or 40. So talk about that conviction component.
Yeah. Well, when you look at how the world treats investing and people own hundreds, if not thousands, of stocks, they don't know what they own. They don't know why they own it. And therefore that causes the fear. And exactly. I would contend that when you get on TV and you pound the table for owning a quote unquote index fund or index funds, or owning a bunch of different funds and you own hundreds or thousands of companies, that feeds into the fear. When you know what 30 or 40 companies you own, there are two significant advantages to that. Advantage number one is we can afford to be picky. We can afford to be very choosy about the businesses that we want to own. And we want to own the best of the best businesses. Now, things happen. Businesses change for the good or the bad. But but that's why you have a buy discipline and a sell discipline.
Exactly.
Right? I often use the analogy about Apple Computer. A lot of people will talk about Apple Computer. And they'll say, you know, I'll say to them, look, you tell me when I should have bought or sold Apple. Because it went from $1 to $100, back down to $1 and almost bankrupt, right?
You got it.
Now being one of the largest companies in the world.
$3 trillion in market cap almost, right?
You tell me when you should have sold that company. Time in a company, not timing. And as long as the company continues to have the fundamentals to execute on, you execute on those fundamentals. So when you can own three or four, 30 or 40 companies in your portfolio, there are certain companies, as you mentioned, the conviction index. We have a conviction index. You can always know by a Nepsis portfolio where our conviction lies because you can look at our holdings. You can Google search our holdings because we have to file them on a quarterly basis with the SEC. And at that time of the filing, of course, it could always change, full disclosure, but you see where our biggest conviction is. And where our largest conviction is, we're going to own more of that company. I find it interesting that everybody loves Microsoft, Google, Tesla, Nvidia. And these are the companies that are pounded on the table all the time. And you go look at an S&P index fund, and all of them are what, less than 1.25% of the total portfolio?
Exactly.
Which means for that stock to, for Apple, let's say Apple's 1% of the index. I don't know what it is, but it's got to be somewhere around 1%. Yeah. That stock has to go to 6 trillion. It's got to double to have a 1% impact on your portfolio. Just think if you bought Apple 10 years ago, I'm had it 5% of your portfolio. And everyone says, ooh, buying individual stocks is so risky. Well, you see what's in your mutual funds and your ETFs, they're stocks,
yeah,
right? And if you put a 5% position in a company and it goes down by 50%, which statistical probability is extremely low. I mean, the COVID environment certainly did that for a lot of names, and that created a lot of buying opportunity. But at the end of the day, a 50% move in a stable economy and market is a pretty big move down and doesn't happen a lot. And when it does, if you have 30 to 40 companies, you can alter your conviction index and how much you want to own in a particular business.
Boy, you said some really good things there. Just to recap this piece, you mentioned the 30 to 40 stocks. So we've done, and there's various studies on this, right, Mark? We've talked about, it's really probably what you say between 20 and 40, that the next stock that you own, it doesn't decrease the standard deviation or the risk, as we call it.
Yeah, without getting too technical for people. You know, when you own 20 to 30, 40 companies in your portfolio, despite what commercials may say, quote unquote, eliminate single stock risk. When you own 20, 30 right. companies, you are eliminating single stock right. risk. Now, you may have a industry that does not perform up to your expectations. You may have a longer term correction going on, or what I refer to as a shrinking of the price to earnings ratio or the price to sales ratio, i.e. valuation metrics of a company. But at the end of the day, when we've been doing this 26 years, at the end of the day, we have been through the financial crisis. We have been through the Asian contagion. We have been through the tech bubble of 2000. We have been through the COVID crash. And our clients have all come out of that line incredibly well. And so it's the process that makes the difference more than the actual individual company, although that is, of course, very important.
I love what you just said there. And that's this study. So I'm going to wrap this. This was certainly episode 3 we did. It was Athena Invest and Thomson Financial. So the study, which I think was landmark, took a look at 40 stocks of money managers. And again, not to get into the weeds, but alpha, which is just additional performance up and above an index, which is the title of that. The top 10.
Hold on. Yeah. Can I interrupt you on that real quick? Yeah. Alpha is a statistical measurement of the risk, the actual risk that is taken to get the returns you get in the portfolio. Not one client has ever asked what our alpha is. Yeah. Not one. They all want to know what the rate of return is.
But
hence the reason for the fear when things go down, because they frankly don't understand, quote unquote, the amount of risk that's been taken. There you go. Sorry.
You got it all. But I want you to address one more thing with this. So I'm going to leave it this. So you get 40 stocks in this study, right? The top 10 add an additional 6.1% in this study. The next 10, 2.3. The latter 20 of the 40 actually detract negative 4.7. But I want you to think about it, because I love the analogy you always use about the building of an automobile. And correct me if I'm wrong, we have 34 stocks in our portfolio currently. There are some stocks in there that aren't necessarily your best ideas, but are used as kind of a protection mechanism, if you will. The brakes to the car, then maybe you're in a race, but you need to have brakes to stop it at some point. So just think about why you would own some companies that maybe aren't high conviction, maybe add a different component.
Right. So that's part of the flexibility and transparency podcasts we'll do later. Yeah. But when you think about it, every company in our portfolio at any given time, we may like one far more than another. And that's the flexibility to increase. We have increased conviction on 3 companies in our portfolio that we have increased the percentage owned of those companies because of the nature of the economy, the nature of the valuations, lots of different things that go into the decision for the conviction. We have 34 companies, but not all portfolios own all 34 of these companies. And that's because we have 5 models that have different investment objectives. So we don't have utilities in our growth and growth and income portfolios. Now, believe it or not, we actually have in the past.
Right.
And those are designed to bring down the volatility in some areas. Notice I say volatility in some areas. That gets to the idea, Chuck, that every position, every company that is owned in the portfolio is owned for a very specific reason.
Absolutely.
Some are going to have a lot more volatility than the others. And the ones, you know, what we did during COVID was we sold lower volatility stocks and we bought higher volatility stocks that crashed a lot more. So when you think about companies like Discover and Square and AMD and CyberArk, all these names we bought at significant discounts. And then as everything cooled down and got back to normal, those stocks significantly outperformed the more conservative stocks. We're now back to adding companies in the portfolio that are not super sexy. They're not super high growth, but they're designed to manage the whole portfolio, i.e. the automobile analogy. Every component in your automobile is there for a very specific reason. Most investors don't care. All they care is that when they press the button, it starts the car. It's the same thing with the portfolio. No one stock should break the long-term performance of your portfolio.
That was a wonderful. Thanks. I wanted to unearth that from you because I love that analogy and it helps people tremendously. So maybe what we can do is we can pivot to what we spoke about last week, which was number four in the series. And of course, this one is to wrap them all up. But the test, remember, we're talking about putting the Nepsis portfolio to the test, because this study that I just mentioned, this Athena Invest Thompson Financial, came up with four qualities that money managers who have conviction and consistency and who can perform over the long term to meet the expectation of their clients have four qualities. So quickly, we're going to talk about all these, but I want to, we went through this one. So the number of stocks held, fewer the better. They said ideally less than 40 is optimal. Yep. You mentioned 34. I don't think there's ever been a time we've had over 40. It's been
We haven't. It's usually been between 25 and 35.
Exactly. The next thing that we talked about, which I want you to hone in on, I think is really good. They talked about assets under management, but we really talked about what allows you to grow significantly is when the structure is focused around a separately managed account. So I want to get into that. And then the last two are the tracking error, meaning the wider dispersion that you have from any given benchmark. I mean, if you're different than any benchmark that's out there, you tend to outperform because you're not hugging what some index is doing. And then the last thing is volatility, the greater, the better. So maybe we'll talk a little bit about that structure, if it's okay, of an SMA and why it's optimal, we believe, for performance and not only clients meeting their goals.
Yes. I love it.
So here's what we're going to do. We got four things, right? So we're going to talk about the customization of holdings in an SMA versus the mutual fund, right? Which is built for the masses, or the ETF. Here's the one I love, Mark: continuous interaction with a manager. When a mutual fund manager, there's no interaction. They can't, right? They can't go to a client or an investor and simply say, hey, you know what? We're thinking of selling XYZ and buying ABC, right? Because that's front running, right? So you don't have that interaction.
Right.
You don't have the dedication to this single investor account. You're in this pooled ownership, which...
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the biggest advantages of an SMA. You know, look, if you want to make money, if you want to invest and you want to make money, wouldn't it stand to reason from a common sense standpoint that you want every possible advantage you could have to help you accomplish those goals?
Absolutely.
Of course, that's a rhetorical, dumb question. Of course you want every advantage. And when you don't commingle your account with other people, it affords you greater flexibility in the process of your buy and sell discipline. When you're not commingling, you can tax manage better. How about Roth conversions? Taking a stock that maybe has been hammered in a year and converting it out of an IRA into a Roth, so it go, you pay tax while it's down and then let it keep growing tax-free. I mean, these are significant advantages. When you have a correction, being able to pick businesses in that timeline of what's going on economically and what's going on with those businesses, how can that not be a great advantage? How about when you're moving money from one money manager to the next, and the flexibility that the money manager has to sell positions that you already own in the most tax efficient manner possible to reallocate your portfolio? These are just a few of many significant advantages of having your own single account versus pooled assets.
Boy, you hit a grand slam on that one. I'm internally, right within our firm, I just want everyone to kind of grasp what Mark just said, because the structure drives the flexibility, which drives the process, which ultimately drives results, right? And what was our motto for the last 2 years? Process before what?
Right? Process before progress. We're actually going to do a podcast on that if we haven't already. I can't remember.
It is so cool.
Process is the result of something is because of a process. And I know we've talked about this with Matt in the past. You know, you go to the doctor's office, a lot of times they don't treat the source, they treat the problem.
Right.
And the problem is a result of a source. Something is causing something to happen. And it's the same when it comes to investing. It's the process that allows you to see the progress over time.
I love it, Mark. And as we go to the last and final wrap up here, I wanted to just for our audience and listeners, ask yourself this question. If you're working with another money manager, is your manager in control, or is he or she being controlled? And I think that's a huge thing, right? And the last person in the world I can think who's being controlled by anything is you and or Nepsis. But just think about that, asking that question, right? Is your manager in control, or he or she being controlled?
Absolutely. Yeah. Obviously, I started my own business probably because I was a control freak.
That's okay. People should love that.
People telling me what to do. I still don't like people telling me what to do, except for my lovely wife, of course.
Yes.
She can tell me anything she wants. But you're absolutely right. When you can be completely deconstrained from everything else, everyone else, and you don't have to have anybody telling you what you should do or what you think you should do. Because everybody's an armchair quarterback. Nothing better when people say, you should have never bought that stock. Really? Do you even know why I bought it at the time? And do you realize that things change? I mean, investing is a continuum. I always say this, investing is not finite, meaning there's not a beginning and an end time. It's continuous. So I hate when people say, oh, I made money today in the market, or I lost money this year. You don't lose anything until you sell it. And the investment process is a process over time. So getting investors to focus on clarity, to focus on process, you would hope and think would deter them from focusing on the major things that inhibit investors from being successful.
You got it. So let's wrap this puppy up here, because that was an excellent lead in. So let's just go over the four here that we went over the last month in this series. The greatest impediment for investors is fear, right? Fear is number two, heightened by a lack of knowledge and control. The studies that we just went over refer to this as ambiguity. If you look it up in the dictionary, yes, it's the antithesis of clarity. Like you just said, they don't have clarity. They have the opposite, which is ambiguity. And the reason they have that is because they don't understand what they own and why they own it. So, Mark, yeah, I wanted to thank you. I get so excited about this, almost jump out of my skin. Probably Matt's got to turn the volume down on my side because I get so excited. But I've loved being on these with you here, and I know there's many more to come, right?
Thank you. Absolutely. We're going to get several more recorded here in January, boss. So fantastic. I think that's it, Matt. I think we've covered what we wanted to cover today. Hopefully this is beneficial for people. Any questions from you? Any comments?
Chuck jumping out of his skin makes me really happy. And no, Chuck, I haven't actually adjusted to your audio. There were a couple of times where you did get excited. But I think the super important thing is, and I want to just highlight a couple of things because I know a lot of people are going to go back and listen to this again, is, you know, thank you guys for making operational definitions so that people understand some of the jargon that you're using, because it is something that a lot of people don't understand. There's number one. Number two, the consistency of the message and you guys lifting the hood of this wonderful high performance engine that you've created to show them the rationale between what you're doing and why you're doing it and how it does go very contrary to what they're hearing in the news, which is why you guys podcast and why it's so important to get the word out in the marketplace. And finally, if you are are sitting around, it's been the holidays, and I'm sure you were all sitting around the dinner table, and people were spewing all sorts of terrible and what we know is stupid stuff about what's going on in the market. Please, dear God, share this podcast with them, open their eyes, and help them understand what investing should be like. So that's kind of my summary with that. And Mark, I'm looking forward to finishing up that other mini series. And of course, yes, your predictions are my favorite podcast that we do all year long, my friend. So
I appreciate it. Looking forward to doing it.
All right, everybody, if you have not subscribed, make sure that you do share this podcast widely with everybody. For everybody at Nepsis, Chuck, and all of us here, we'll see you on the other side of the mic very soon.
The content discussed is for informational purposes only. It is not a solicitation or recommendation for any securities that may be mentioned herein. Advisory services offered through Nepsis, Inc., an SEC-registered investment advisor.